I hope you have Bibles along with your pizza, so that you can follow as I read Revelation 5 and then in the exposition. Revelation 5. Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept, because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He came and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands, and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped. This is the word of the Lord. Chapter 4 is to chapter 5 what a setting is to a drama. And now the drama unfolds, and it will be easiest, it will be simplest to follow it step by step. First, the scroll. John sees a scroll with writing on the inside and the outside. Now, if this were a codex, a book like this, writing on the inside and the outside makes very little sense. All the place you have room for on the outside entitles you to a title and a blurb or two, but that's about it. But in the case of a scroll, in theory, you could write as much again on the outside as you have on the inside. Now, in the ancient world, that normally wasn't done. Most scrolls were made of papyrus. Papyrus has the feel of lettuce or rhubarb, but its cross-section is triangular. And what people did was take a little nick at the top and pull off a whole strip to give you a papyrus strip, and then nick another little piece and pull off another strip and put it down beside it until you had quite a number of these vertical strips. Then you pulled off some more strips and laid them out horizontally across the vertical ones. Excuse me. And then pulverized them together with some kind of organic glue, and that gave you one papyrus sheet of paper. Then you glued or sewed that sheet to another sheet, then that sheet to another sheet, and eventually a full-length scroll would be 32 to 34 feet in length. Then you'd stick a stick on each end and twirl them in, and there was your book, your scroll. In fact, one of the reasons, I'm sure, why Luke Acts is two books is because both Luke and Acts take about 32 feet. You just didn't have scrolls that were bigger than that. But in the ancient world, whether you were writing in Greek, from left to right, or Hebrew, Aramaic, from right to left, you wanted to write on the inside, because on the inside was where all the strips went horizontally. If you were writing on the outside, your quill pen was jumping over all the vertical connections, you see? So people tended to write only on the inside. But under certain conditions, you were on both sides. The reason I mention this is because this text tells us quite explicitly this scroll in the hand of the Almighty has writing on both sides. Why? Well, in the ancient world, you wrote on both sides for one of two reasons. First, you were too poor to buy another scroll. Well, I doubt that that's the reason why the Almighty has writing on both sides. Or, for some reason, legal or otherwise, you want all of the material in one place. You want the whole thing there. In some, for example, long legal document, a complicated will or the like, you might not want volume one or volume two. They might get separated. Things can get distorted. So it becomes a way of saying this is the fullness of what is disclosed. And in fact, as you read the book and break the seals and so on, you discover that what this scroll contains is God's purposes for judgment and blessing for the entire universe. That's what's in the scroll. It's in the right hand of him who sits on the throne. That is the hand of power. But the fact that there is writing on the inside and the outside is a way of symbolizing that this is the fullness of God's purposes for judgment and blessing. The whole thing. It's all here. All in the right hand of him who sits on the throne. Then after the scroll was filled up, what they sometimes did, especially if it were a legal document, was take one more papyrus sheet, wrap it around the outside, holding the two together, and then tie it. Or, if it were a legal document, put on wax blobs and stamp them with a certain seal. And the more important you were, the more seals you got. So the will of the Emperor Vespasian, for example, was sealed with seven seals. Moreover, in something like the will of the Emperor Vespasian, even if there were a copy made that were kept in the archive somewhere so that people knew by looking up in the archival copy what the will's proclamations were, nevertheless, probate, the equivalent of probate, was a matter of slitting the seals. In other words, even though they knew what the copy said, the actual coming into effect of the stipulations of the will was a matter of slitting the seals. That was the defining moment. You opened then the original, and all of its stipulations took place. Now, that is the symbolism that's presupposed in this drama. Here you have a book with all of God's purposes in the right hand of the Majesty on high. How will those purposes come about? Because, after all, they're sealed with seven seals. What you must have now is a ceremony of the slitting of the seals, as it were. Someone who comes along to slit the seals, to bring God's purposes to pass. And so that brings us then to this mighty angel. I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" Now, he's a mighty angel because he is speaking to the entire universe. And he does not have a PA system. Someone like George Whitefield could apparently preach to as many as 50,000 people in the open air. Now, that sounds like a ministerial estimate, doesn't it? But in fact, it's an estimate that came from Ben Franklin, who, though no Christian himself, enjoyed the company and friendship of George Whitefield. And on some of his larger meetings, Ben Franklin would walk around the outside of the crowd and then take his measurements about how many square yards there were, and then average out how many people per square yard, and do his calculations and say, 50,000 people. Now, of course, dear old George had a sounding box behind him, and he would speak downwind, and preferably in a little valley, and so on. He used the tricks of the trade, but nevertheless, 50,000 people's not bad. I suspect that my brother here could come pretty close. I can't. You see, I believe in Clint Eastwood. A man's got to know his limitations. And so I rely on microphones and things. So if I want to reach a bigger crowd, well, I just go closer to the microphone, you see, or somebody somewhere in a little room turns up the amplifier. And so I can speak to large crowds too, but by natural gift, I really can't. Well, in days without PA systems, you have to have a mighty angel because he's addressing the entire universe. And so his proclamation goes out to the entire created order. Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? Now, it's at this point that you see the importance of the setting in chapter 4. In other words, the question is this. Granted the God who has just been described, the God who is removed from us by an entire fallen order, The God who is mediated to us by His Spirit. The God before whom even the highest orders of angels doff their crowns and bow before Him in constant praise. The God who cannot be described, even, except by the most extravagant metaphors. Who then has rank so exalted, attributes so full, life so perfect and holy, as to be able to approach the throne of this God and say, "I'll do it," and lift the scroll from His right hand and bring to pass all of God's purposes? That's the question. And there is a pause. A silence. No one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. That is, not even the cherubim around the throne. No human being, no angel, no necromancer. Under the earth, a biblical euphemism for the abodes of the dead. No dead person gone over. Or even to look inside it. That is, suppose that someone could have said, "Well, I can't bring about those purposes, but at least I could sort of lift up a ledge and get a sneaky peek about what's coming." So we come to the tears in verse 4. "I wept and wept, because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside." Now it is important to understand John's tears. He is not weeping because he is a nosy Parker and is frustrated because he can't quench his curiosity. He understands the symbolism. He belongs to that age. He understands that literature. He weeps because, in the symbolism of this developing vision, if no one is found who is worthy, God's purposes for redemption and judgment will not be brought to pass. So how will you right the wrongs? How will there be justice in the universe? Who will be saved? Maybe life isn't fair. Both this life and the life to come. Maybe God will not end up the winner. Maybe all the sufferings the church has gone through and will go through are all futile. Maybe Paul's alternative begins to make sense in 1 Corinthians 15. "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die." Now I submit to you, it's important to keep pressing this point in our generation. We have lived through about half a century of high-level philosophical thinking that doubts the moral structure of the universe. Thus the existentialists insisted there was no ultimate meaning other than the meaning that is formed by choosing to act. Probably the most influential theologian in the first half, a New Testament theologian, in the first half of the 20th century was Rudolf Bultmann. He insisted that the meaning of history has become meaningless. And in an increasingly hard form of postmodernism, it becomes easy to believe that there is no objective truth to any belief. You may confess certain things in your particular heritage, but that doesn't mean that they're really true. They're what you choose to believe. In America at large, faith today means personal religious choice. That's what it means. It never has that meaning in Scripture, but that's what it means today. Personal religious choice. John understands the entailment. There is a huge loss. The loss of justice. The loss of direction. The loss of teleology. The loss of purpose. Other than the peculiar, parochial, self-centered purposes of me. Or me and mine. Or my group. Even in international affairs, this reigns. Stanley Fish, one of the American semi-pop gurus of a hard form of postmodernism, was asked after 9/11, 3 years ago, whether his views on evil had changed. After all, the towers came down, and for the first time in about a decade, secular newspapers were actually addressing the question, is there such a thing as evil after all? Haven't we seen evil when people take jet engines and rev them at high speed and fly a plane full of people and jet fuel into a building and 3,000 people die and people burning with fuel jump out of top buildings and fall down 90 floors and smash on the concrete below. Do we have a category for evil? Stanley Fish said, of course not. I haven't changed any of my views. It just proves my point. Obviously, the people who jumped out of the building thought it was evil. People running away from the dust cloud thought it was evil. The firemen cleaning up the mess thought it was evil, but take a look at your TV. There were others in the streets of Cairo, Heliopolis. There were people in the streets of Baghdad. They were dancing in the streets for joy. It all depends on your point of view. What's evil? What's bad? What's good? What's heroic? What's stupid? What's carnage? What's righteous indignation? What's just? It all depends on your point of view. It makes exactly my point, he says. So he was asked, well, does that mean that we shouldn't fight the terrorists 3 years ago? He said, no, I'm not saying that. Of course you got to stop them. But why? He said, I belong to the American tribe. So now the fundamental reason for stopping them is not questions of right or wrong, or truth or error, or justice or injustice, but what tribe you belong to, and therefore what power comes out of the barrel of your gun. We live in a generation that isn't even smart enough, morally speaking, to weep. At least John understood the entailments of his vision. And he wept. Then in the midst of the tears, one of these elders, an interpreting elder, says to him, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. Now, anyone with any knowledge of Scripture knows what allusions are being made here. The Lion of the tribe of Judah is simply the King of the tribe of Judah, the great, promised, Davidic son, great David's greater son. He is also called the Root of David. This language, of course, is drawn from the glorious vision of Isaiah 11, where this messianic figure is described as both the root and shoot of David. I used to live in Vancouver and served a church there 3 decades ago. And Vancouver, a really wonderful city, is graced downtown with an area called Stanley Park. It's a peninsula that goes out into the Sound, and you can bike it all the way around. It's quite a long way to go, and walk it and enjoy the scenery. It's a spectacularly beautiful area. And it used to be, it's no longer the case now, but as you came off the main drag across the bridge and turned right, there was a parking place to the left with a zoo and an aquarium. The zoo's no longer there. The aquarium still is. Still worth going to. When you parked your car, there was a tree there. A stump. A B.C. Douglas fir. Now, that's the best Canada can do. It's not quite a redwood, but close. You know, these giant redwoods that are so spectacularly large that occasionally you've got a hole through which you can drive a car. Well, these BC Douglas firs aren't quite that glorious. I mean, after all, it is Canada. It's a lot farther north. But on the other hand, they're not bad. You have some of these tree stumps that are 15, 18 feet in diameter. That's a pretty big tree. The Indians, 150 years earlier, used to take them down with their stone axes. A 15-foot diameter tree, and roll them into the sound, and then hack them out with their axes to make ocean-going dugout canoes. Can you believe it? And that's what had happened to this tree. The stump is still there. You can see the marks where the Indians had, maybe 150, 200 years earlier, hacked this thing down, rolled the thing into the sound, and made their canoe. And what's left is this stump. But it's been preserved so that you can see it for yourself. And out of the middle of this stump is growing a BC Douglas fir. Now, I'm not a biologist. I don't know if this is because some rejuvenation has taken place at the core and it's growing again, or more likely, some new seed has fallen in and there's enough rot in there that it's begun to send forth its own roots down into the soil. But, you know, I don't know. But it's spectacular. This huge stump, and out of it, this tree, maybe 2 or 3 feet in diameter, growing up again. And every time I went into Stanley Park, I thought of Isaiah 11. For the promised one is not only David's root. In some sense, he's antecedent to David and supports David. He's David's shoot. He comes out of David's line when the dynasty is knocked off, when it seems as if there is not going to be any more Davidic figure on the throne. He emerges, the root and the shoot of David. He has prevailed. The verb is a strong one. He has prevailed. After a struggle, he has prevailed to open the scroll. Now, you must understand the setting here. Here is John, weeping his eyes out, frustrated, desperate, because it looks as if there is no future, no justice, no promise of blessing, nothing. He's weeping. And the interpreting angel taps him on the shoulder, as it were, and says, "Stop your crying. Look, look, the lion from the tribe of Judah, he has prevailed. This root and shoot of David." In fact, at the closing chapter of the book of Revelation, that's how Jesus identifies himself. "I am the root and the shoot of David. The root of David, he has prevailed to open the scroll." So John says, "I looked and I saw a lamb." This does not mean that there are two animals there, parked side by side, a lion and a lamb. This is mixed metaphor. The lion is the lamb. It's why you can't draw it. The one who is announced as a lion, the one who is announced as a shoot or a root, is also perceived as the lamb. The lion is the lamb. Someone has said, "None but an inspired composer of heavenly visions would ever have thought of it. When earthbound men want symbols of power, they conjure up mighty beasts and birds of prey. Russia elevates the bear, Britain the lion, France the tiger, the United States the spread eagle." Nobody mentions Canada the beaver, but we'll let that pass. To go on, "The United States, the spread eagle, all of them ravenous. It is only the kingdom of heaven that would dare to use as its symbol of might not the lion for which John was looking, but the helpless lamb, and at that, the slain lamb." He's almost got it right. What he's got wrong is the antithesis. Not the lion, but the lamb. The point is, he is both the lion and the lamb. That's the whole point. Not only so, but although he is a slaughtered lamb, looking as though it has been slaughtered, he's got the death wounds on it. It is an astonishing lamb. It's got 7 horns on its head. Remembering that horn is a symbol for kingly power? And 7 eyes. So a perfection of knowledge and a perfection of power. So this slaughtered lamb is also perfect in strength. Perfect in self-sacrifice and perfect in strength. Kingly authority. Another way of saying that this lion, this lamb, is in fact a lion. He's the one who rules. And not only so, now you understand why this one didn't need to approach this God from the outside. Where did he emerge from? The text tells us. He emerged from the throne itself. I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne. Now, again, it's the setting of chapter 4 that is so crucial. Everything in chapter 4 makes God other. It makes God transcendent. It makes God different. But this lamb belongs there. This lamb doesn't have to sort of acquire divine status. He emerges from the very center of the throne. It's another way of affirming in the strongest possible apocalyptic imagery that he is divine. He is God himself. He came and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. Now it is important to think through what this means. There are several ways that we could do this, but probably the most efficient is to examine carefully the praise of heaven that erupts after the lion has taken the scroll. And then in the following chapters, the seals are broken, and other things follow from this. There are vials, there are trumpets, and so on. All of the drama of the book of Revelation turns, nevertheless, on this vision. So, now it is important to see what the text says is the response of heaven. When he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Now, from here on in the book, almost every time, not quite every time, but almost every time when God is mentioned, or when he who sits on the throne is mentioned, the Lamb is mentioned as well. Thus, for example, in 13, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. In other words, the whole book becomes the book of the triumph of the Lamb. The Lamb was associated with God in absolutely everything from here on in the book. Do you see? Now each one of these four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, as they had fallen down before God in the previous chapter. Again, it's the chapter preceding that sets the stage for what this means. They give the Lamb all the reverence that is due to God alone. He is their maker. He is their creator. He is their sovereign. He is their God. Each one had a golden harp, a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints, and they sang a new song, which tells us why they accorded him this praise. Now, let's begin with the harps. I'm sure we've all seen these endless line-drawing cartoons of people sitting on clouds wearing nightgowns and strumming harps. Doesn't it make you really hungry to go to heaven? If that's what heaven's going to be eternally, quite frankly, I think I'd just rather be annihilated. I don't mind listening to a good harp now and then, but an eternity of it, wearing a white nightshirt? Nah, I don't think so. But this really misunderstands the symbolism at the time. It really does, in a very bad way. The harp was an instrument of joy. You recall how the Jews, when they were taken away into captivity, testified by the rivers of Babylon, there we hung up our harps? That is, they stopped playing their happy instruments. They had nothing to be happy about. They hung them up. Our enemy said, play us a song of Zion. Ha, 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 go on, take your harps down. How can you sing a song of Zion in a strange land? So what is the instrument of joy in your culture? Banjo, maybe? I mean, it's really hard to connect banjo and dirge in your mind, isn't it? I mean, you ever heard a banjo played at a funeral? There's something fit-stomping happy about a banjo, isn't there? I mean, unless you really loathe all forms of blues and all forms of country and all forms, unless you know that music with a passion, it's hard to be really grim listening to a really first-class banjo player, isn't it? Now, if that's not your instrument of joy, then choose the one. Maybe it's a pipe organ with all the stops out. Whatever it is. You know? The point is now, the harps come down. This is a way of saying now that instead of the tears, you have reasons for joy. Because since someone has prevailed, someone has been found who is worthy to open the scroll, then all of God's purposes for judgment and blessing will therefore take place. That's what causes the joy. The joy now is that justice will be done and be seen to be done. God will be justified. His own people will be saved. And in the praise of all of this, then, there is great joy. That's the setting. That's the significance of the harps, whether you connect it to a banjo or a pipe organ. As for these prayers like incense, the symbolism is again drawn from the Old Testament. Let my prayer be set before you as incense, the psalmist writes in Psalm 141. Now, this can sound to our ears just a bit vaguely Catholic, and so we become suspicious. I was brought up in French Canada. I went into Northwest Saint Joseph in Montreal, where this vast, vast Catholic cathedral with a candle room with literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of incense candles. Well, you paid, at the time, inflation, you know, it's gone up. But at the time, you paid 10 cents for a one-hour candle, and a buck for a week candle, and whatever it was, 10 bucks for a month candle. We actually had some year-long candles there, and you paid your money, and as long as the candle was burning, it was the equivalent of a prayer going up. All scented, you went in there, and it was supposed to remind you of heaven, this wonderful incense. Now, someone with that kind of background looks at this text and starts saying, what do we make of this? Crypto-Catholic? Now, of course, the imagery comes from the Old Testament instead. And you must understand that it was an age without Rightguard. They didn't have deodorants. And their hygiene habits weren't quite what ours are. Their bath routines were a little more primitive, and showers were not daily events. So that in many homes, therefore, there were little incense bowls around that sort of made the place more pleasant. And that became a kind of analogy in the Old Testament writer's hand, as in Psalm 141. Let my prayers come before you like incense. That is something pleasant, something that is offered up, something that in some ways hides all the grotesqueness and the bad smell and all the failure. Let it come before you as something pleasant. That's all it's saying. Do you see? The imagery is picked up then here. For this is now saying, in the light of the drama, that now it is worth praying. Otherwise, it is not worth praying. If God's purposes for judgment and blessing are going to be frustrated, if no one is going to be found who can slit the seals and open the scroll, then what's the point of praying? What's the point of praying that people get redeemed? What's the point of praying that justice will be done, which is part of your kingdom come, your will be done in heaven and earth? What's the point of praying any of that? If, in fact, the scroll with all of God's purposes remains sealed. But now the lion has prevailed. The lamb has prevailed. The seals will be broken. All of God's purposes will come to pass. So the prayers are now being offered up before God as incense, accepted again before Him, do you see? So not only is one of the fruits this joy symbolized by the harps coming down, the tears of joy are now gone, but also the prayers now become purposeful, fruitful, sensible, part of God's redemptive purposes and means. May I put it this way? This is unthinkable. This is impossible. But it's probably the only way to get the point across. If Christ had not come and died as the slaughtered lamb, if he had not prevailed in this way, no one would have been found to open the seals which bring to pass all of God's purposes for redemption and judgment. RTS would not exist. You would not be a Christian. There would be no assurance that justice would be done in this world or in the world to come. There would be no new heaven and new earth for God's image bearers, there would simply be universal condemnation. That's it. Wipe the whole lot out. But as these angelic beings lift their voices in praise to the Lamb, singing a new song, a song of redemption now, not the song of creation, they address him and they say, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals and give the reason." They do not even give the reason because you came from the center of the throne, which you did. They go right to his death. In the drama of chapter 4, he couldn't have approached this God had not come from the center of the throne. That's like affirming his deity. But affirming the eternal Son's deity does not by itself make him the one that brings to pass all of God's purposes for redemption and judicial judgment. No. He prevailed. He was found worthy to bring to pass all of God's purposes because, they say, you were slain. And with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. So it was a bloody atonement. Blood in the New Testament most typically symbolizes not merely life, but life violently and sacrificially ended. So that in Paul's writings, for example, everything that you sometimes find said that the blood achieved is elsewhere said to be achieved by the cross or by Christ's death. It is a bloody atonement, perhaps one of the most penetrating hymns written in this regard is one by Wesley. Am I allowed to quote Wesley here? "Arise, my soul, arise. Shake off thy guilty fears. The bleeding sacrifice in my behalf appears. Before the throne my surety stands. My name is written on his hands." Reminds me of a lovely story of A.W. Tozer. He was preaching one Sunday, and at the end of the sermon, he came to the narthex, and at the door, a young man he had never met before came out and said, "Good morning, my name is Jesus Christ." Quick as a wink, Tozer, who was shaking his hand, opened up his hand and said, "No, you're not, you're a liar. My Christ has the marks of the nails." Just so. "Before the throne my surety stands, my name is written on his hands. 5 bleeding wounds he bears, received on Calvary. They pour effectual prayers, they strongly plead for me. Forgive him, oh forgive, they cry, nor let that ransomed sinner die. The Father hears him pray, his dear anointed one. He cannot turn away the presence of his Son. His spirit answers to the blood and tells me I am born of God. My God is reconciled, his pardoned voice I hear. He owns me for his child, I can no longer fear. With confidence I now draw nigh and Abba, Father, Abba, cry." It's a bloody atonement. It's a broad atonement in the sense that it draws together men and women from every tribe and language and people and nation. There is not a hint of racism here. Part of my job is to travel quite a bit. And I know that there are different sensitivities in all kinds of areas. But I tell you, I like to go to Sao Paulo and visit churches there. Precisely because they are spectacularly colorblind. Well, they've got their own problems. I can tell you about some of those too. But they are spectacularly colorblind. I like to go to some churches that I could tell you about in Queens and San Francisco and LA like that. The coasts have got that better than we do. I was at a church recently in Queens, a Reformed Baptist one, as it happened. And the reason I was there, I personally spoke to people from about 40 different countries. And there was no stereotyping. I met a black guy right out of Rikers. He had been involved in drugs. I met another black guy who was head of anesthesiology at a nearby hospital. I met a white guy who was son of a mafia don, and another white guy who was head of accounting of a major firm. I met Japanese, I met Chinese, I met Portuguese, I met Scots, I met them from everywhere. And I thought, we taste of heaven. Because you see, they have been purchased by God from every tongue and tribe and people and nation. Now, we all have our history and bad habits and all the rest. But I would love to see the Church of God, wouldn't you? I would love to see the Church of God taking the lead in bringing such reconciliation to pass rather than being at the tail end of social change. Because after all, we might as well get used to heaven. We're supposed to be the heavenly community already transported back into time. We're sort of an eschatological outpost way back here now. Now, of course, it's not the consummation. I know that. We don't have resurrection bodies and all the sin isn't washed out of us yet. I know that. But still, that's what we're supposed to be, isn't it? Enjoy it. It's a directed atonement. We're not just saved from sin, but for God. In fact, in Scripture, those two are different sides of the same coin, aren't they? But there is a brand of cheap evangelical theology that sees salvation from sin, but somehow does not see entailed in that salvation to God, of being purchased for God. They want that to be a second step. Impossible. Because, at the end of the day, there's still nothing but sin unless we are exclusively God's. What? Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit which is in you? You've been bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body, Paul writes. It's a triumphant atonement, verse 10. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God. That is, the peculiar domain of the uncontested reign of God. Right now, God's reign is contested. His kingdom is contested. But on the last day, in the new heaven and the new earth, it will no longer be contested. And right now, we are together priests in that we mediate God to the world around us. This is mission. And we take the concerns and cares of the world and bring them to God on our knees, in our intercessions, in our prayers. This is why Paul, when he's talking about evangelism in Romans 15, can picture his work as his priestly service. We don't have priests in the sense that we have a separate designated category for intercessors or intermediaries or the like. We have priests precisely in the sense that we have those between God and human beings who mediate all the grace of the gospel to a damned world, to which we by heritage and birth and nature and choice belong, from which we have been redeemed. We're like poor beggars telling other poor beggars where there's bread. We're priests. Here's the new song. And the consummation comes in a new heaven and a new earth. The meek right now might be the downtrodden and the persecuted, but there is an eschatological expectation. They will reign on the earth. That changes everything. They will reign on the earth. Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive a sevenfold list of attributes." That is, this is the perfection of praise. Power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. And then one final step. I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The universe joins in. The tiny dust beam dancing on a sun ray, the farthest quasar, the forests, the woods, the glens, everywhere. Because you see, the salvation is not only for me, Don Carson, the individual. It's for this entire renovated universe. And ultimately, when the whole thing is brought to its consummated end, the entire order of things is offered up before God in unending praise that recognizes its creaturely status, the sovereignty of God, and the redemption that has secured this perfection.